This is a Rabble Podcast Network show. New voices in your head. It's Radio Free Radio.
You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 100.5 FM.
The link between poverty and health has been studied for quite some time, and the conclusions are clear. If you're poor, you're likely to suffer more and die sooner from whatever ailments you have. Heart disease, diabetes, and cancer afflict people from all walks of life. But what about poverty itself? Should poverty be treated like a disease? Last month, the BC Poverty Reduction Coalition hosted a talk at SFU Harbour Centre on the topic of poverty and health. The featured speaker was Dr. Gary Block. Dr. Block is a family physician at St. Michael's Hospital and is founder of the advocacy group Health Providers Against Poverty. Along with Dr. Block were Fraser Stewart, a longtime resident of the downtown East Side, and Dr. Vanessa Bursick, a Vancouver area family physician. The first speaker of the evening was Fraser Stewart.
I've been not a long time on welfare. I was 3 years on welfare. Right now I'm on my pension. And in the month of June, I had a heart attack. 1 month after taking my pension. They told me when I took my pension that my health care and medications would be covered, no problem. The second month in, I went to the pharmacy to get my prescription filled. And they said, that'll be $89.98, please. And I said, what? On the grand total of $645, which is my pension, after I pay my rent, my telephone, and something to eat, there's not a hell of a lot left. So I walked out of there without my medications. And I was without my medications for 5 days. I wasn't feeling all that great. When my health practitioner, who is here somewhere supposedly, found out, she called up the ministry and she gave them help. I've gone through, so far, five CAT scans, three MRIs, four echographs, and numerous EKGs. That they have no problem paying for. They have no problem at all. But the medications that I need, that they won't pay for. So, supposedly it's being taken care of. It's being taken care of by the Heart Foundation right now. And in 6 to 8 weeks, I'll be back under full coverage. But what do you do for 6 to 8 weeks? You have a choice of putting a roof over your head, buying food, or getting really sick. Either one, all three of those things, if you don't have it, will kill you. Basically, they'll kill you. I've known poverty from both sides. I worked for 8 years in a homeless shelter in Montreal. Before that, I was an airframe technician at Canadair. I was earning over $100,000 a year. I left that job to work for $14 an hour. It was very rewarding. I met extremely, extremely beautiful people. Some of them are, I consider as my sons. I never thought that I would end up in a homeless shelter, but I did here in Vancouver, sleeping on a mat that cost the government $1,150 a month. That's what it costs to keep somebody in a shelter. Speaking of shelter, somebody on welfare, basic welfare, they get $375, that's your shelter allowance. In the Lower Mainland, an average apartment costs over $1,100. Welfare rates haven't been raised in over 8 years. Just think about it, 8 years, $610. How much of that has been eaten by inflation? Yesterday, I should have brought one of the posters. We did the same talk in the Carnegie Center, and our poster was Murder by Policy. And we had arguments about that name. Gavin's got one right there. We've had arguments about that name, but that's basically what it is. I'll also talk to you about one of the cigarette sellers in front of the Carnegie. He's not one of the drug dealers, he's one of the cigarette sellers. When I was walking into the Carnegie this morning, he told me that he was a pipe fitter working for $38 an hour until he crushed his back. He's got terrible arthritis, he can hardly walk. And now he's been diagnosed with a tumor. But he's still not sick enough to get onto disability. So he sells cigarettes. And he says once a month he gets busted by the same cops. And he said, you know, I have no choice. He said, just like you, you have a job to do. And he said, I have a job to do. This is all that I can do now. A year and a half ago, we had an MLA from Surrey who met the welfare challenge. We brought him down to the welfare office. This is a man with two master's degrees, and he couldn't fill out the forms. They are so complicated.
23 pages.
And that's the small form. Because I just got my disability form, and it's 47 pages. And I can't fill it out. Things have got to change. Right across from where I live, there are over 250 people right now sleeping in tents. Many of them do have housing. I'm not saying they're all homeless. Many of them come from SROs. And they're better off in the tents than they are in their SRO. Really, they are. There's people watching out for them. They feel safe. There's no bugs. There's no rats. Their stuff is safe. That's another thing that's got to change. Welfare rates, pension rates, they're all way too low. And another thing that's way, way too low is minimum wage. When a working mom working for $10.25 an hour has got to spend over $11 an hour to keep her kid in daycare, on top of paying her bus fare, her food, and everything else, it's ridiculous. I know one girl who was a drug addict, who went through rehabilitation. She got a job at $20 an hour. Sounds good, right? But it's only 20 hours a week. Her rent is $1,400. They took her kids away again. She's back on drugs. So that's got to stop. That's about all that I have to say. Thank you.
That was Fraser Stewart, a longtime resident and advocate in the downtown East Side. He spoke at a public forum hosted by the BC Poverty Reduction Coalition on the topic of poverty and health. The next speaker was Dr. Gary Block. Dr. Block is a family physician, as well as an assistant professor with the Department of Family and Community Medicine at the University of Toronto.
Honestly, I think everything I have to say was already said tonight by Fraser. I think that if you heard his words, you will hear every reason that I do what I do and every motivation that exists behind what I do. So it's really been said. I will try and reframe that for you a little bit, put in a slightly different context, but I'm not sure I have a lot new to say beyond what he said already. You know, since I've been here, I've heard a lot of anger. And I think there's a lot of reason for that anger. And I got to say, I feel angry, right? I mean, in the last couple of weeks, as has been mentioned, there's been reports about the rise in inequality in Canada. There's been reports about how this, my home province, has the highest poverty rates, the highest increased rates of poverty in Canada. You know, my current home, Ontario, just released a completely toothless second poverty reduction strategy. You might say at least we have a poverty reduction strategy. I'm not sure it actually puts us that far ahead. And on top of that, I just came back from a six-month leave away from home and back into my practice, and my patients are telling me the same stories they always told me. They tell me they're struggling to eat, to stay housed, to find work, just to survive. So I'm here to tell you about why I care about reducing poverty. And I could easily spend the next half hour going through the powerful research evidence that links poverty with poor health outcomes. But I won't. I think that most of us know this evidence, whether we're numbers experts, of which I'm sure there are a few in the room, or just from what we live and see and hear every day. As we know in Canada, and as we've already said, there are hugely increased rates of chronic illness, acute illness, even accidents and trauma amongst the lowest income people. And this is true here, and it's true around the world. That link between poverty and poor health is truly universal. So my colleagues need no convincing when it comes to this evidence. And why? Because we sit here and we listen to stories like Fraser's story every day in our offices. And these stories are the real emotional drivers. They're incredible pushes to action for us. So I think this is where I'm actually going to start, or what Fraser already started for us, is again from these stories that I see and hear every day. And as I think is often most powerful when it comes to addressing the reality of living in poverty, I want to build a picture of how our approach to reducing poverty as doctors has developed from listening to these stories. So let's start with Fatima. Fatima's 32. I've known her for about 5 years. In that time, she's had her second child. She comes to see me pretty regularly, about 5 to 6 times a year for herself and her kids. She worked for a while at a fast food restaurant, but as a single mom with few social supports, she's had to rely mainly on social assistance for financial support. And in Ontario, that gives her about $1,200 a month from the Ontario government. She lives in market rent housing, and this sucks away more than half of her income. She's been on the subsidized housing waitlist for years, and as we heard recently, that waitlist is bigger than it's ever been in Ontario, 165,000 people. She comes to see me with various physical ailments, joint pains, itchy rashes, mostly related to childcare or work, and for recurring depression. Her kids have suffered from anemia, poor weight gain, and behavioral problems at daycare. Then there's John. I met him at my clinic in a homeless shelter about 8 years ago. He was originally from Nova Scotia and came to Toronto for a job in construction. He lost his family to divorce, then he lost his job to chronic back pain. He lived on welfare for a while, but he lost hope, and then he lost his home. When I met him, he lived on the streets, in ravines, and in shelters for 6 years. He'd lost contact with basically all of his friends, and he hadn't spoken with his children in 3 years. He occasionally drank alcohol, but rarely got drunk. He was disheveled, sad, lonely, and fearful when I met him. He still had the back pain, he had on and off chest pain, and he had a pretty constant cough. So these types of patients make mine and other doctors' hearts sink. Not because we don't know how to deal with back pain, depression, or itchy rashes, but Because we know that traditional medical teaching about how to deal with these conditions will not help the Fatimas or Johns that we meet. In our offices, we know all too well that revolving door of health problems for our patients who live in poverty. And we know all too well that that door will not stop spinning until they come out of poverty. But what exactly are we as health providers trained in prescribing drugs and ordering blood tests supposed to do about it? So this is the question I've been struggling with for over a decade. How do we move from dealing with what medical textbooks tell us are our patients' most important problems to what our patients and our own observations tell us are their most important problems? And in my practice that's centered in inner city Toronto and largely focuses on people who live in poverty, it is low income that rears its head over and over again. So what to do about it is not necessarily obvious to doctors. So I'd like to throw out some lessons that I've learned in developing an approach to addressing poverty as a doctor. To start, I think it's incredibly important to see poverty as a disease. Now, the health evidence supports this quite clearly. Like other chronic diseases, like diabetes and heart disease, poverty tears away at our patients' health over time. It wears away at their physical and mental integrity and causes progressively more and more disability. As I mentioned, I was recently out of the country for a six-month leave, and a few months in, I saw a media article featuring one of my long-standing patients, and it turned out he developed a terminal cancer. He's in his early 50s with a long history of homelessness and mental health concerns, and I'd seen him intermittently over the years. I was incredibly sad to hear this news and to find out in this way, but I was not surprised. His terminal illness started a long, long time ago when he lost his financial and social supports and his housing. And I've seen this happen so many times now that I consider my patient's disease process to start not with a traditional medical diagnosis like that cancer, but when they fall into long-term poverty. Life expectancy for a man on the streets of Toronto is around 45. And as was shown recently in Hamilton, the difference in life expectancy between the richest and poorest neighborhoods is decades. So the diagnoses we look to can be that obvious final cause of death, or we can appropriately look upstream to the real illness. But we have to make sure that we're able to make that diagnosis. So to do that, we now teach medical trainees and doctors to ask every person that comes through their offices about their income at their first meeting and at least once a year thereafter. I would like to see income at the top of every medical chart, at the forefront of every health provider's understanding of our patients' health issues, and incorporated into every treatment plan. We can only do this by making sure we know what our patient's financial situation is. As many of you know, poverty is often hidden, and unless we ask the right questions, we may never know the full extent of the financial illnesses that our patients are struggling with. And then, before we get into directly treating poverty, I need to talk about the impact of a diagnosis of low income on our medical assessments. I think that health providers should be using the evidence on poverty and health to inform our decision-making about diagnosis and treatment. For example, while there's a huge body of evidence linking diabetes with poverty, the leading guidelines on diabetes in Canada make no mention of screening for or treating poverty, and in fact mention poverty only twice in the entire document. So when the large guiding bodies aren't properly taking into account the evidence, it's left up to us as individual health providers to do this work, to know the evidence and to figure out how our patients' income might be affecting their health. So this is where I need to search for those cancers, that heart disease, that diabetes in my patients because they suffer from severe social illness. And this is where I am sadly not surprised when my patients who live in poverty develop these conditions when not otherwise expected, at an earlier age or without other risk factors. So beyond this more traditional type of thinking, if you can call it that, we also teach doctors to directly treat our patients' poverty. And now this really makes doctors' ears perk up, because I think this has always been the missing piece of the puzzle. While we may recognize the importance of poverty to our patients' health, we often try to pretend it's not there simply because we feel impotent in the face of its power. We have no toolbox for addressing this powerful social disease. So we teach that as health providers, we need to know the ins and outs of the income security system, the disability support system, the tax system, and the employment system. We need to become experts in these areas or work with experts in these areas. Let me give you two examples. A patient of mine, Janet, is a 27-year-old mother of a 7-year-old girl. She, like many Canadians, works part-time with no extended benefits, and she gets about $22,000 a year. Her partner is on EI for about $200 a week. So they are barely scraping by, and they live with the constant stress of not knowing if they're going to be able to pay their rent or afford food at the end of the month. So we did a careful interview and some research together and discovered that she qualified for the Canadian Child Tax Benefit, the Ontario Trillium Benefit, the Ontario Child Benefit, and the GST and HST credit. And this gave her an additional $4,700 a year in extra income. Another example, Harriet and Harold. A retired couple in their early 70s living on $700 a month in company pensions. When we looked at their benefits, we discovered they qualified for a total of $2,900 a month through Canada Pension, Old Age Security, Guaranteed Income Supplement, the Guaranteed Annual Income Supplement, plus that private pension. So these are Ontario numbers, but there are similar programs across the country. And these are huge increases in these patients' incomes, and I consider these to be high-impact health interventions. And if they were routinely carried out somewhere else in our social support system, I wouldn't have to worry about it, but they aren't. So this essential intervention becomes my responsibility. So this forms the core of what we've been teaching doctors and other health providers, but there's another side to this story. Teaching these interventions makes us doctors feel a little bit better, like we can do something about poverty, and hopefully it helps a little, but I think that we all know that this is a drop in the bucket. Poverty is a systemic issue. It's built into our society and the financial and political systems under which we live. Around 1 in 7 people in Canada live in poverty. We've already talked about BC having the highest poverty rate in the country. Disproportionately, people living at low income are Aboriginal, of color, children, people with mental and physical disabilities, the elderly, and women. These are also single men who are falling out of the capitalist system and have no supports to hold them up. And then along with that frank poverty, as we've already mentioned, we see this rising inequality. That gap between the top and bottom wealth tiers is increasing, and there are fewer people in the middle. And that inequality in itself is known to be detrimental to the health of all Canadians, at the top or the bottom. Governments, they're not doing very much to address this poverty. In both BC and Ontario, along with those increases in the spread between rich and poor, we've seen huge real cost decreases in welfare benefits, rising or stagnant poverty rates, and a failure to implement necessary anti-poverty strategies like a universal child care plan, a well-funded housing strategy, or universal prescription drug coverage. I, in fact, started down this path after being pulled into a campaign led by the Ontario Coalition Against Poverty, aimed at increasing social assistance rates in Ontario. And alongside the rallies, the speeches, the meeting with government representatives, the media grabbing creative actions, we ran public clinics, clearly marketed as Raise the Rates action events, where we assessed people for and prescribed an income supplement to welfare known as the Special Diet Allowance. And at that time, the way the program was, we were able to prescribe the full $250 a month supplement to every person who came into those clinics based on a diagnosis of poverty. So that marrying of frontline clinical work with systems-level advocacy has informed the construction of my approach to anti-poverty work in the decades since. So because of that, I worked on framing poverty as an individual-level diagnosis, but I also believe we have a responsibility as doctors to diagnose the ills of our communities, our society. I think it's our duty to point out that pervasive poverty and rising inequality is built into the political and financial systems we live in. And I'm certainly not the first to say this. There's a strong history of physicians linking health to social ills, tracing probably most famously to Rudolf Virchow 150 years ago. But doctors too easily forget this part of our assessments. Maybe because of the overwhelming predominance of technology, because of time pressures, because of the sense of helplessness, maybe because of class conflict of interest. But the other side to the story, the big picture reason I've been working on teaching doctors how to intervene into poverty, is that I would like to see doctors use our power as part of that top 1% or 5%, our disproportionately loud and privileged voices towards tackling what is truly the biggest determinant of our patients' health. And since doctors seem so stuck on treating disease, I spent this time reframing what they may see as a social problem into a medical problem, and what they may see as a social cure into a medical cure. And my hope, and this has never been a hidden agenda, is that this may compel my fellow physicians to start addressing poverty in a bigger way, to start pushing governments, the general public, the corporate sector to see poverty as the public health crisis that it is, to urgently devote resources to tackling poverty in the same way we've devoted huge portions of our society's resources to tackling smoking, traffic accidents, or cancer. I want to see doctors as individuals and through our powerful organizations working to eradicate poverty as if it was HIV. And I think this may help because doctors are listened to, because we have the ear of decision makers, and because we speak as some of those who benefit from being at the top end of that inequality and income scale. And I've seen this play out in various ways. I've seen doctors and other health providers work in the anti-poverty advocacy world to some success. I've been involved directly in campaigns to increase social assistance rates, to raise the minimum wage, end discrimination against refugees in the health system, and work towards a guaranteed annual minimum income for all. And I've seen medical organizations start to pay attention. This Committee on Poverty and Health with the Ontario College of Family Physicians, a pretty consistent focus on equity from the Canadian Medical Association, good efforts to address equity from the Canadian College of Family Physicians, and this alongside the traditionally strong voices from the public health and community health center worlds. So I don't know if our work in reframing the medical understanding and treatment options for poverty has played a role here, but I wonder whether it's helped to catalyze the conversation somewhat. There is consistent interest in including our approach in teaching for medical trainees and practicing doctors. And the media, if it can be used as a bellwether for public interest, seems to be intrigued by this approach. So to return to Fatma and John, I don't know yet whether this approach has improved their health. For both of them, we've worked to increase their income and continue to see the treatment of their social situation as essential to their path to better health. But my conversations with them continue to include a sense of frustration and urgency. I can't magically create housing or an appropriate job for John. I can't promise Fatma subsidized childcare or that her next job will pay a living wage. We have a long way to go as health providers in our ability to treat this illness we call poverty, and as a society in making sure we don't allow our neighbors to suffer from its ill effects. But I do hold out hope that the voice of health providers just may lend some new sense of urgency to our efforts to eradicate this plague we call poverty. Thank you.
We've been listening to Dr. Gary Block. Dr. Block is a family physician as well as an assistant professor with the Department of Family and Community Medicine at the University of Toronto. He was speaking at a public talk held at Simon Fraser University's Harbour Centre campus. The talk was hosted by the BC Poverty Reduction Coalition. You can find out more by visiting the coalition's website at bcpovertyreduction.ca. The next speaker is Dr. Vanessa Bursick. Dr. Bursick is a Vancouver area physician as well as an instructor and researcher at the University of British Columbia in the Department of Family Practice.
I would like to share with you today some important contextual pieces to the vivid conversation that we've heard tonight. I'd like to call us to some collective action and share with you some existing projects in BC. But first, I will share with you the story at the root of all of this that has been clear and troubling to me since I was a medical student 10 years ago. When the demand for doctors is greater than the supply of doctors, we have the luxury of doing our jobs by taking whomever comes knocking at our door. There are always patients knocking at our door. But those who knock the loudest are generally those with the best access. There are many others who don't come knocking, because they are working two or three jobs, because they can't afford transit or childcare. These are familiar stories to us. Many patients are busy meeting their basic needs, which means that if we do not look beyond our doors to the communities that we serve, we often miss those patients that need our care the most. I believe that this practice of first-come, first-served medicine, without consideration of population health needs, is discriminatory. We must use our clinical lens to see the needs of communities and populations, and therein, I believe, lies the solution. In BC, we need to begin by breathing truth and action into the practice of patient-centered care. Making room for each patient's unique experience of illness and suffering is what is most fascinating and rewarding about primary care, and why I, like Gary, choose to work with high-needs patients. If we develop a patient-centered care system for complex needs, including poverty, all healthcare providers can practice as we do, with social determinants of health at the heart of the clinical encounter. However, in BC, family doctors are paid in a fee-for-service model that many patients know as one problem per visit. This model simply does not support us to address social determinants of health. You might have heard about an alternative model called a medical home. This is a patient-centered model endorsed by primary care leaders and governments around the world. BC is simply not following suit in developing medical homes, and this has to change. We need to support family practitioners to work in healthcare teams that are patient-centered, and yet BC is making no substantial steps towards this goal. I've already described a bit about doctors' habits of busying themselves with running a clinical practice without considering population health needs. Although this sounds like doctors just doing the best they can, this story has a unique face in BC, in which a small group of vocal physicians are rapidly growing the for-profit healthcare industry in this province. BC's story cannot be ignored. We have a government that is underinvesting in all public services relevant to the social determinants of health. This includes education, social services, ambulance, rehabilitation services, and healthcare. The result of this is not only mounting inequities in BC, but increasing for-profit services, filling the gaps left in our inadequately reformed public system. I can't think of a worse way to address inequities than a two-tiered health system in which the wealthy can pay for privileged access to the scarce resource of doctors and nurses. If we want an equitable system, we absolutely need to reform our public system and oppose the overt privatization and profitization within our health system in BC. On a brighter note, there is this movement in this room in BC to address health and income inequities, and as Gary described, The movement is founded upon legitimizing the place for social determinants in the doctor's office. Let me share with you two brief examples. With two of my most esteemed colleagues who are in this room, Sarah Dobson and Manjeet Chand, we co-founded the Basics for Health Society earlier this year in our spare time. It began as a pilot project funded by Impact BC based on the Health Leads model in the USA. We train dedicated and talented students, our future healthcare providers, in compassionate, patient-centered communication and the nuts and bolts of how to help patients meet needs related to social determinants of health. The students are patient navigators, they are a resource hub, and they allow concrete capacity to address socioeconomic needs in clinical settings. At the heart of this model is our commitment to mentorship and a more inclusive understanding of health amongst the next generation of healthcare providers and leaders. Advocacy is a core skill for health providers that is generally poorly understood and poorly taught. We hope that Basics for Health can help to change that in BC. Physician advocacy has largely been for our own working conditions and wages, but evidence indicates that these benefits for increased billing amounts do not trickle down to patients. Health providers of all stripes complain around the lunch table about ways the system is not serving them, and this is an excellent place to start translating this valuable clinical lens into systemic action, as Gary mentioned. With underfunded health and social services in BC, each profession fights for adequate compensation, which is completely antithetical to collaboration required to address broad health issues like the social determinants of health and poverty. So I challenge all of us in this room to discuss and partner with our allies in the professions for our collective voice is stronger and more mature than our siloed fights for adequate funding. I believe to address poverty and its impact on health, we need a collective vision. For example, the top issue that Basics for Health volunteers help patients with, as per patient need, is the need for affordable housing. Yet the volunteers, since the program's inception in 2012, have not succeeded to connect one patient to affordable housing through the route of BC Housing, which is supposed to be serving us. The BC Housing wait times are unacceptably long. And as healthcare providers, perhaps our collective voice for affordable housing might actually get us somewhere. The Divisions of Family Practice is another initiative that holds a lot of promise in BC. It's got a peculiar title, but remember it, because most communities in BC have a Divisions of Family Practice, in which family doctors are solving problems on a community level. Unfortunately, in its early stages, most of the divisions have very much a biomedical focus. But the Kootenay Boundary Division of Family Practice in the interior have begun to address poverty and social determinants by developing regional and provincial tools to help health providers address poverty in their practices, modeled after Gary's tool that he developed with the Ontario College of Family Practice. I think this is but the tip of the iceberg in the leadership role the divisions could take in addressing social determinants of health. So let's call upon them to address it. I believe that doctors need this movement, a demand from their communities, from their healthcare allies, and from public health to look beyond their clinical biomedical paradigm to equally important socioeconomic needs of patients. As Gary mentioned, we tend to see biomedical issues first, but that does not mean that the social needs are any less important. And it is the doctor's responsibility to listen to this evidence in keeping with our obligation to practice evidence-based medicine. And finally, and most importantly, we need to hasten the culture shift in medicine towards compassion and away from patient labels such as difficult patients and non-compliant patients. This jargon represents a doctor-centric view that absolutely overvalues biomedical issues and undervalues socioeconomic needs. It is not patient-centered, and so we need to get rid of it. One theme in my research that has come out of it has been the unintended harm of not addressing poverty, even in the context of increased vigilance for the increased medical needs of patients living in poverty. If we don't treat poverty as a disease, as Gary said, and if, for example, a patient living in poverty is depressed, offering them an antidepressant can be harmful if what they truly need is housing or income security, and especially if they cannot afford prescriptions. Within the social determinants for that patient is the potential for a cure, whereas a prescription can be unaffordable, and even beyond that, dismissive of the root cause of their depression. In this way, a biomedical focus can augment the stigma of living in poverty unless we address social determinants of health, including poverty, alongside medical needs. Poverty and needs related to the social determinants of health are not always well circumscribed as they are in the Downtown East Side. Poverty in BC is unfortunately everywhere, in every medical office, and I hope you will join us in a collective effort to address health inequities across BC. I hope I've been able to give you some ideas about how we can begin. Thank you.
That was Dr. Vanessa Bursick. Dr. Bursick is a family physician and a researcher at the UBC Department of Family Health. She was speaking at a public talk held at Simon Fraser University's Harbor Center campus. The talk was hosted by the BC Poverty Reduction Coalition. The last segment is an excerpt from the question and answer session held after the main talk.
Thank you. My name is Bill Hopwood. I'm the organizer for Raise the Rates. And last night we held a similar but somewhat different meeting in the Carnegie Center last night. And it was filled with people's experiences. There were 10 people giving experiences like Fraser gave. And we could have had thousands. Across British Columbia, we could have at least half a million, because there are over 500,000 people in BC in poverty. Gary didn't need to tell us last night that poverty kills, because the people in that room had lost friends or were suffering ill health. If you'd been there and heard the experiences and heard the evidence from Gary and the other medical evidence, you would have acted to end poverty, not to alleviate it, not to soften it, to end it. So you have to say that the government and the politicians have no heart, because they hear these stories, they see the evidence, and yet they continue to allow people to live this way. We had some discussion about poverty as a disease, which Gary says, because it's a very particular and special disease. It is a disease that is controlled. How many people get it is controlled by the government. They could eradicate that disease in 5 years in British Columbia, or they can let it grow and spread as an epidemic across this province, because there is no reason why in a province as rich as British Columbia, anybody should live in poverty. We have the money. Trish made the point it would actually save each individual in British Columbia $1,000 a year if the government acted to end poverty. I would suggest that it is a political decision to subsidize the very rich at the expense of the rest of us, which is why we have poverty in British Columbia. $3 billion in tax cuts would eradicate poverty. That was the tax cuts every year that the government's given away. We pay for it, we live it. This is a statement, but in a sense, it's an invitation to the panel, whether a doctor or an activist, to speak to that broader systemic issue of how do we build the movement of doctors, of poor people, of Indigenous people, of all of us, to change so that we can eradicate poverty in British Columbia, and maybe at the same time also care for our earth. Thank you.
Just a quick response, Bill. Thank you for your comments. I think there's two things I'd like to point out. One is, there was a movement that started a few years ago in Toronto called Doctors for Fair Taxation, and I would love to see that grow to social servants for fair taxation, or to broaden the voice, which speaks to my second point, which is how crippled we are facing underfunding from all public services. Because right now, as I mentioned, the strongest advocates in every profession are going to preserving their own working conditions so they can do a good job. What that does is it means that we're almost pitted against each other in competition for funding, which truly undermines the collective voice for addressing broad issues like poverty. And so I think that one thing that we truly can do is ally with other professions. And as much as we are advocating, doctors have to the least of everyone for fair funding for our services. What we can do is partner with other healthcare professionals and other social and public servants to call for solutions to these together, because with the culture of underfunding right now, that collective voice is crippled, and that's something that we can overcome through collaboration.
Yeah, I just want to bring it to, I mean, Fraser mentioned the title of last night's event, which was Murder by Policy. And I think there's actually some copies of that poster. I saw them outside on the way in here, and it says blood red dripping letters that say, and I plan to hang that on my office until the hospital makes me take it down, which will probably take about half an hour. But we'll see what happens. But there's really something to this. If we look at government revenues right now, they are at their lowest rate relative to our GDP since 1980, right? So we have systematically stripped our ability to fund the kinds of social services and programs that help people stay out of poverty. And this is a choice. This is a choice we make as a society. It's a choice we make as the people who run our society, but also as the broad voting public. We keep putting these people into power. This can change, and I really do believe this can change. This Doctors for Fair Taxation that Vanessa mentioned, this was sort of a small little fun campaign in some ways that I was involved in, but it made a big statement, right? And it actually had a fairly big splash in the sense that, shockingly, there were people earning high incomes willing to come out there and say, tax us, right? Tax us, because we believe in a society and a system that supports people and that doesn't allow people to fall to the bottom. And what we actually saw from that was, for the first time in many years, an increase in taxes in Ontario on highest income earners, right? I mean, it was a pittance. It was on people earning over $500,000 or something. But it was something, right? It just showed that can move even a tiny bit. And we need to push. We have the money to do it. It is entirely possible this needs to change.
This hour, we've been listening to excerpts from a discussion about poverty and health in BC. The talk was held at Simon Fraser University's downtown campus and was presented by the BC Poverty Reduction Coalition. To find out more about the coalition's work, please visit bcpovertyreduction.ca.